Radio EcoShock.
There is very little online about the work of Paul Virilio in English, but you can find a two-part introduction and assessment on YouTube from John David Ebert. Ebert is a cultural critic, intellectual, and author of 25 books. He investigates difficult minds, and he takes us along for the ride. From Arizona, John David Ebert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, I'm currently in Santa Fe now, Santa Fe, New Mexico, but thank you.
All right. Well, what attracted you to this French philosopher?
Well, Paul Virilio, I was researching for my 2010 book, Dead Celebrities, Living Icons, and I had not bothered reading French postmodern philosophy up to that point. So I decided to read Jean Baudrillard because I knew a little bit about his philosophy of the simulacrum, and I knew he would have interesting things to say about avatars and so forth, and he did. But as I was reading through him, I noticed his references to this other individual, Paul Virilio, and I looked him up, did a Google on him, and I saw that he was famous for his ideas about technology. And at the time, I was very much interested in reading anyone and everyone who had theories about technology. And so I started picking up Virilio's books and reading Baudrillard and then Virilio back and forth until I was completely addicted to both of them, especially Virilio. And so that's when he entered into my life at that point.
So what the heck does Virilio mean by the term the dromosphere?
The dromosphere is his central idea, and it comes from the Greek word dromos, meaning speed. And so he has this idea that as our civilization has progressed, especially since the 19th century, things have gotten faster and faster and faster. There are two revolutions, he says, that went through the 19th century. One is the transport revolution, where we moved from horses to trains, and then eventually to automobiles, and then in the 20th century, of course, with rockets and airplanes. So the physical form of the human body has been accelerated through space faster and faster. And he also has this idea that as we move faster, the phenomenology of our perception changes. Like if we get into a car and we drive fast, the windshield becomes almost this kind of screen that distorts our perception of the landscape around us. Lateral vision disappears. We scan the windshield for any kind of collisions or whatsoever. And the whole phenomenology of what we see isn't really out there. It's in here. And so in a certain sense, the driver becomes a kind of artist with the passenger as a kind of spectator. But also the other thing, and this is more important than the phenomenology of speed, is that as we speed up, the danger of accidents actually increases. And so he has this idea that with each technological invention of motion through the dromosphere, it brings into being a new kind of accident. The invention of the first boats brought the shipwreck into being right along with it. And as in the myth of Daedalus and Icarus, the Greek smith who invents wings and basically the first airplane to fly, but his son Icarus falls and crashes. And so the Greeks are already sensitive to the idea that when you invent a new technology like flying, you're also inventing the plane crash. You invent trains and you invent the train crash. And now he says we're on a threshold of acceleration to the point where the media are now accelerating and have laid the foundations. Globalization and the global, what he calls the vision machine, which is all the electromagnetic apparatus, have now laid the foundations for the first global accident. And I think that more or less there he predicted the COVID pandemic.
So what is it about Virilio's global instant that causes yesterday's story and then really almost all previous history to disappear for a lot of people? When I talk with people on the street or even online, it seems like they haven't built up anything from the history that humanity got until, you know, maybe 2001.
Yes, and that's because of the other revolution, not the transport revolution, which accelerates history, but the acceleration of the virtual with the information revolution that went along right beside it, first with the telegraph, then with the telephone, and then radio, and then eventually computers, and now the internet. There has been an acceleration such that it has created what he calls the aesthetics of disappearance, the first instance of which is if you're sitting in a movie theater, you have what's called persistence of vision, at least in the celluloid days, where each frame is constantly evanescing and vanishing, but you have persistence of vision so you can assemble a coherent image out of it without seeing the frames in between. But then as the information technologies, what he calls the information bomb, have exploded on us, we get this constant aesthetics of evanescence in which the present becomes the only thing that's real and the delayed mental space of history disappears, the space in which an event happens, then there's sufficient time for us to reflect on it and then write books about it, articles, magazines. That's the old Gutenbergian world of the delayed mental space. Now we don't have that delay because everything is instantaneous. Every event that happens, happens simultaneously all over the planet. And so we wind up with this aesthetics of disappearance in which we have an acceleration of the virtual and we're stuck with it. And so history vanishes. And all we get now are no longer historical actualities, but simply random scattered events like 911, say, or just pick your event. And they're disconnected and fragmented because our minds are wed to the present moment because of these technologies.
That's brilliant. I really get that, especially when we see how the news moves from one strange accident or shooting or somebody runs down others in a parade. That becomes the focus for half an hour, and then it disappears, and then we get a new accident. And Virilio essentially said that now what we have, this civilization, is an accident.
Yeah, the whole thing is an accident. That's right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, and none of those stories are connected at all. They're just random. They seem to be like Charlottesburg happens, and then it's in the news for 48 hours, and then suddenly it never happened. No one ever refers to it.
Not long after you posted your two-part YouTube video on Virilio, you published the book Age of Catastrophe, Disaster and Humanity in Modern Times. What in Virilio's work reveals a coming age of catastrophe?
That book was inspired by my interaction with Paul Virilio, especially his fascination with accidents. And he was founding what he called an accidentology. So the logos or the study of accidents, which was totally new to me. I'd never encountered it anywhere ever before. And I thought it was fascinating to study accidents almost as works of art. Or he wanted at one point to found a museum of the accident in Paris. I don't think it ever did happen. So I took this idea and I ran with it, and I started thinking, well, maybe there's a lot more in these accidents than people think. For example, Virilio would talk about these events and he would make references, oblique references to the Titanic, let's say, or the Hindenburg, or the space shuttles. But he would never go into detail on them. And so I decided to write a book where each chapter would be devoted to a different accident, starting with the Titanic and the Hindenburg. And the book is divided into three epochs then. Paleomodernity, which is essentially goes all the way down to World War II, then neomodernity, which moves from World War II basically down to the year 2000, when I see accidents becoming so large that they are planetary in their scale. And so when we start with that first epoch with the Titanic and the Hindenburg, we have these very symmetrical accidents that have a cause and effect that's easy to identify, and they don't ramify across space and time. They're contained. Certain specific things have happened with the Titanic, so now we need to make the telegraph 24 hours, for instance. We need to have enough lifeboats for everyone. So, and then we're done with it, and we move on. Certain number of people die, and that's it. But in the second epoch, and the book only has two accidents from paleomodernity, in the second epoch, though, we move into an age, such as with Bhopal, the accident that was a gas leak in India in the 80s, a poison gas called 7 that leaked, a giant cloud, killed a lot of people and harmed a lot of others, and also Chernobyl and Fukushima. Accidents like this are no longer containable in one place and one time, and they keep ramifying their effects even across generations. I mean, there are unborn children in Ukraine who were close enough to Chernobyl that they will bear birth defects on for generations. So the effects of these accidents in the middle epoch here get larger and larger, but not quite yet planetary. And then we move into the age of catastrophe proper right around the year 2000, where we start getting planetary scale disasters like these giant tsunamis in 04 and the one in 03, I believe it was, that brought YouTube into being so people could upload their videos of it. So YouTube was actually born out of a catastrophe, note that. And those giant tsunamis, the Japan one that caused the Fukushima disaster, huge tsunamis, and now ultimately the one that we're facing is the big one, which is the collision of industrial civilization with the biosphere, which is global warming. And global warming is now planetary in scale. It's a planetary accident that is the result of Western civilization's technologies crashing into the biosphere, just like the Titanic crashing into a 10,000-year-old piece of Greenland ice. And so now the ice is melting as the result of all of this CO2 that we've been outgassing for well over a century now. The parts per million are up around 412. I just looked today, 412. When I wrote the book 10 years ago, it was at 395. So the CO2 levels are going up astronomically fast, and there's a direct correlation between those levels and global average mean temperature, which has risen by 1.2 degrees over the past century, and also sea levels have risen by a foot. So this is what we're looking at here, and that's what that book is about.
Yes, we're living those catastrophes here in British Columbia, where I am. We had the superheat dome that killed over 600 people, which was a total shock here in Canada. And then we had these atmospheric rivers that closed off all the highways to Vancouver, one of the biggest cities of Canada, with landslides. The whole earth was destabilized. So it seems like catastrophe is now just a way of life.
It is for us, yes, and almost to the point now where because of man-made technologies interacting with the planet, with the ecology, all the ecological systems, you almost can't even say anymore that there is any such a thing as a natural disaster. They're all man-made now because there's a direct correlation between the rising of the sea levels and the heating of the seas to produce larger and larger hurricanes. They're getting larger and larger and more severe. And we're also getting hotter and hotter years. Every year seems to be hotter than the one before it. I think the two hottest years on record now are 2020 and 2016. And the seven hottest years on record have all now transpired over the past decade. Basically, it's getting hotter and hotter, and with more and more CO2 and more floods. We've had a lot of floods. I guess you guys had a lot of floods recently, didn't you, in Vancouver?
Mm-hmm. Have you written a book about climate change, or are you considering one?
No, I've been there, done that. This book was my sort of nod to acknowledging the reality of climate, which I knew nothing about before I wrote the book, until I sat down to read about it, and then was so horrified I had to write that book. And so, no, that's as far as I'll go with writing on that subject.
So as I read Virilio's books, he seems to be in mourning. He mourns quietly the disbelief in his Catholic faith. But the real thing that's bothering him, it seems to me, is that we don't even have an agreement on what is real. People have alternative facts, so they say, and there seems to be more people believing information coming online rather than what their own senses or their own mind might tell them. What do you think?
Well, yes, I mean, that's part of the information bomb, what Virilio calls the information bomb, with the acceleration of virtual reality through the internet. It also has the effect of deworlding people. And this is what I call hypermodernity, which is the same thing, the information version of the age of catastrophe, which began with in 1995 when the internet was turned over to the public and made part of the public sector. And ever since then, we've seen all of physical reality pretty much disintegrate. Our shopping malls are now ghost relics on the landscape. Everything went in through Amazon and purchasing things online. And so it created this kind of suction effect where the entire world interior of capitalism was sucked into the internet. All our devices and gadgets, cameras, phones, have been sucked into the internet now. And so digital technology comes in to displace electronic technology, which was bequeathed to us by Stanford during World War II, which was analog. And so all the analog technology is gone. Our movies now are strictly, they're no longer celluloid. They no longer have a physical substrate to them, anchoring the images in something real. That's gone. The images are entirely digital. They're artificial. And as we know, and as I've learned, I had a data crash earlier this year where I lost lots of files on my hard drive. These technologies are unstable. They don't last. They are evanescent, just like Virilio said, and they completely destabilize our sense of what we think is real. And so people get the avatar, my Facebook avatar, let's say, my YouTube avatar, these become deworlded entities. That is to say, they're removed from the locality of place, time, and circumstance, and they're put inside the internet at the speed of light. And so right now, as we talk through this conversation, we are talking at the speed of light because our data, our voices are translating energy into electronic or digital impulses. So we're moving at the speed of light right now, and that's basically what has happened to the world. And as Einstein pointed out, when things move at light speed, certain phenomena happen, such as the fact that time slows down and stops. That's essentially Virilio's point about history collapsing into the present moment. Mass becomes infinite, and no object, of course, can go the speed of light other than light particles themselves, photons, because they don't have mass. But things become compressed and flattened at the speed of light, including our sense of subjectivities as a human subject. That's flattening out too. So this technology, as it accelerates thoughts and ideas and images to the speed of light is extraordinarily unstable, flat, and really figure without ground. There are no world horizons that anchor this material to something real and concrete. I no longer, for instance, read physical books much anymore. I read almost everything online now, reluctantly so, but that's just the way the culture has gone. And so I sort of miss my contact with the smell of the printed page and being able to write on the pages as I read. That's been derealized by this information bomb.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is culture critic and author John David Ebert. We are trying to understand the continuing crisis, and we're looking at the work of French philosopher Paul Virilio. We know that information companies build profiles about each of us, and they tailor not just advertising, but a lot more. For example, algorithms on Facebook and YouTube are geared to stoke fear or anger. Virilio saw this coming, didn't he?
Yes, in one of his last books, The Administration of Fear, which is the book that I talk about on YouTube, he talked about the administration of fear being a byproduct of this acceleration, of this information bomb. We're constantly in a state of panic. When something happens, it happens now to us all, and so there's this global pressure on us to synchronize our emotional responses to disasters such as 9-1-1, such as COVID. These are now synchronized at a global level, and so and especially with COVID, we're all made to feel fearful. By Dr. Fauci, by the World Health Organization, whoever's in control, the NIH, we're made to feel fear through the synchronization of all of our emotions via the simultaneity and instantaneity of the internet. And so it does. It creates this environment of fear and anxiety. And we're also always being sort of sadistically having pressure put on us to catch up to the latest technological invention, to update our Facebook page, to get on to the latest site. To make sure we have the latest phone without our compliance at all. No one ever checks. This is never put up for a referendum or a vote. It just happens. So there is no political economy, as Virilio says, to keep up with this pace of change. We're just expected to adapt or die or drop out.
Should we consider Paul Virilio as an update on Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian, from the printed word to computer screens? Is there some of that?
Yes, very much so. Virilio is the study of technology. Technology is itself a form of media. And so media studies comprises all technological extensions. And McLuhan had this idea that all of our technologies are extensions of the physical body. For example, clothing is an extension of the skin. The wheel is an extension of the foot. The computer is an extension of the central nervous system, and so on. And so he founded media studies in the 1950s, along with Harold Innes, at the University of Toronto, and became famous in the 60s. He was on every talk show in existence in the 60s, talking about media. And then sort of Virilio has, of course, read him and studied him, as has Baudrillard, and inherited that tradition and transformed it into French postmodern philosophical theory, philosophical thought, thinking about technology. And so he comes right out of that same tradition with a recognition of these two different streams, the transport revolution and the information revolution. So he very much is the sequel, the update to McLuhan. I found him to be just as brilliant as McLuhan. McLuhan is my favorite thinker of all time as far as media studies goes. I think he's the best.
And you wrote books and YouTube videos on other difficult French philosophers. Does Virilio fit in with groundbreakers like Michel Foucault or Gilles Deleuze or Félix Guattari?
Yes and no. He is part of that whole, let's say, thought ecumen or thought ecology. So he belongs in there. He knew those guys. He's from the same world, but he always felt like an outsider because first he started as an artist and he thought he was going to be an artist. And so his interests were in architecture and art, not in philosophy. So he was different in that sense. And he's also different in the sense that he's the only one, as far as I know, out of that group who is not a Marxist, but a Christian, which gives him a very different view, a different slant. And his primary competitor, I think, was Baudrillard. I think the two were sort of in competition with each other, and they are the most like each other out of that group that includes Foucault and Deleuze and Guattari and Lacan and all of those guys. So yes and no, he's definitely part of that world.
What is it about French thought that really didn't penetrate very deeply in North America or other parts of the world? It seems to be almost ghettoed into French language only. Do you think that it translates well, or what is the, why don't we know more about Paul Virilio?
Well, he's obscure in a certain sense because he's so difficult to read and is so erudite. Same problem with Baudrillard as well, and also Deleuze and Guattari, especially with their masterpiece, A Thousand Plateaus, which I think is the best book written by any of those guys. It's an absolute masterpiece, and it's extraordinarily difficult to read. Which is one of the reasons why I devoted YouTube videos to trying to popularize these ideas. But on the other hand, they have penetrated into the world of American academia through, in the 1980s, Derrida especially penetrated with deconstruction into the world of the universities and began the process of deconstruction that has led us to, I think, the deplorable situation that America is in right now with the woke left hijacking everything, canceling everything, and spreading this deconstructive nihilism that started in American universities in the 80s, and now, it's being taught to our children in grade schools. It's absolutely ridiculous. Their minds are not ready. They're not adapted for this. They're not ready for that kind of thinking. So it has had a huge effect. Derrida and Foucault especially, who both have this similar attitude of nihilism and the getting rid of historical meta-narratives. It's Foucault who announces in the introduction to The Archaeology of Knowledge that we don't need to bother anymore with macro-historical narratives. We're just going to study micro-narratives, small-scale narratives that are European-only. Because if we talk about, let's say, Indian history or Chinese history, then that's a form of intellectual colonialism, which it absolutely is not. It's a form of narrow-minded thinking. And so I was slow to warm to the French, and now I've had my flirtation and fascination with French philosophy. And I don't really, I recognize its greatness, but I think it's a very small greatness when compared to, say, media studies, American media studies, which I think is much more insightful, or, and beyond that, to German, of course, great German philosophical idealist thinking that starts with Immanuel Kant and goes all the way down through to Heidegger and Peter Sloterdijk, who is a contemporary German thinker. I much prefer German thinking. I think it's much more profound and satisfying, and it's not deconstructive. It's not about getting rid of everything. The French started that with the French Revolution. Let's get rid of everything. Let's get rid of the calendar and put in a metric system. Let's get rid of all historical references to gods and biblical myths and so forth. It's just ludicrous. So there's a great line, a very solid line that extends from the French Revolution down to Foucault and Derrida, and the very sad thing that is happening now with the effects of that nihilism on American socioculture.
Well, what about you? I mean, we are in a difficult time. Do you find yourself in pessimism because of that?
Well, yes and no. I'm kind of an optimistic pessimist, I suppose you would say. I recognize that historical processes are necessary, and sometimes difficult processes, as in the living of your daily life, are necessary to go through to get to another point, to learn something so that you can get to another point. That's one of the reasons why terrible things happen to us. We're here to learn. So, yes and no. I mean, it's pessimistic in the sense that the culture is disintegrating. I think Oswald Spengler nailed that when he wrote The Decline of the West in 1918, and he predicted that it would be downhill for the West from that point, which it absolutely has been. But that doesn't mean there can't be great spiritual experiences that can happen or transformations in human consciousness that are undergoing right now metamorphosis even as we speak, and we don't even know it because we're not aware of these processes. They're mostly unconscious and subliminal and macro-historical. And it was McLuhan who said that, the fish can't see the water that it's swimming in. It's only when you come out of that water that you can look back, oh, there's the water, now here's the air. Let's analyze the water. And so we're swimming in the waters of a very difficult time for this planet. And the course is just to grab onto something strong, i.e. spiritual. For me, I'm very spiritually grounded, and I think spirituality is the most important thing about being human, and it is the thing that will weather any storm, no matter what.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is culture critic and author John David Ebert. We are trying to understand the continuing crisis, and we're looking at the work of French philosopher Paul Virilio. Everything seems destabilized and fuzzy, like a dangerous mystery. I used to think, well, I sort of understand global affairs, but now there are so many twists and changes coming that, as you say, we can't see the water that we're in.
The changes are accelerating just faster and faster, just like Virilio said that they would.
What other tools do you recommend to people who are shocked or puzzled or seriously worried about these times?
Well, to read good books, that is to say, good books that where you know the author has some sort of spiritual grounding in something, and it doesn't have to be New Age spirituality. It can be Christian spirituality, as is the case with Virilio, or with Marshall McLuhan, who was a Catholic. They were very grounded men, individuals, or an individual like Joseph Campbell with his study of all the world religions and mythologies. It needs to be something that has a spiritual foundation to it, like Rudolf Steiner, the great German mystic who founded the Waldorf schools and Anthroposophy and so forth. Those are the things that I would recommend grounding oneself in, because when you have a very strongly built-up spiritual immune system, then you can get through anything, because the culture as a whole is not grounded. It's an atheist, materialistic society still, primarily to this point. That will change and is changing. I'm not, formally religious, but I am spiritual. I believe in things like reincarnation and karma. And if you believe in such things, then you begin to realize, what I do, how I treat this person will have consequences at some point down the road. It's important to have that.
So as we wrap up on Paul Virilio, are there, say, two books that you would recommend people finding and reading if they want to understand what it is he has to say for us?
Yes, I would recommend The Administration of Fear and The University of Disaster, which are two of his latest books, but they're two of his best, and they're short. Short is a virtue when it comes to books these days. People don't have the attention span to read them.
And John David Ebert, how do people find you and find your work?
I have a YouTube channel. Just type in the three names there, John David Ebert, and same thing on Amazon. I have I think about 30 books total by now. I've lost count on Amazon, so that's where all the books are, and all the videos are on YouTube.
You just heard from cultural critic, editor, and author John David Ebert. Find links to follow up in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.